This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're broadcasting today from the Newseum, Washington, D.C.'s newest museum devoted to journalism and the news business. There's an audience of high school journalism students with us here in the night studio, and we want to thank you for coming in today. In 6 days, no more rallies, no more ads, no more polls, but there's still time for one more pre-election visit with the political junkie.
There you go again.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
My mother was born before women could vote. My daughter got to vote for her mother for president.
But I'm the decider.
On Wednesdays, NPR's political editor Ken Rudin joins us to talk about the presidential campaign in particular and politics in general. As the days dwindle down to a precious few, Obama does a Perot, Palin out-mavericks the Maverick, and Senator Stevens campaigns for re-election as a freshly convicted felon. Later in the program, senior news analyst Daniel Schorr joins us to take your calls about this year's campaign and about every other one since Stevenson Eisenhower. But first, it's the political junkie. As always, Ken's here with a trivia question.
Hi, Neil. 6 days to go.
Six days to go.
Okay, two trivia questions today. We'll do one now and we'll do one later in the show, both on Senate races.
All right.
Elizabeth Dole in North Carolina facing a tough battle with another woman candidate, a female candidate, State Senator Kay Hagan. When was the first time two women ran against each other for the U.S. Senate?
So if you think you know the first time two women ran against each other for the United States Senate, major parties, give us a call. Our phone number here is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and we'll also take answers from anybody here in the audience at the museum as well. And Ken, if people watch TV, it's going to be hard to miss Senator Obama tonight.
That's true. I mean, in addition, he's purchasing a half hour at 8 o'clock on NBC, CBS, Fox, Univision, MSNBC, a lot of networks. I think it's $1 million per network. It'll be a biographical sketch. I think when you have $100 gazillion, you just don't know what to do with it. You have to spend it somewhere. He's also going to be on Comedy Central tonight with Jon Stewart, which can be seen at 11 o'clock. He has, I think, an interview. He's going to be campaigning with Bill Clinton. He's everywhere.
And, you know, even if John McCain had the money to buy a lot of ad time, there's not a lot left. Obama's bought it all up.
No, he hasn't. And that's what happens. I mean, it's so interesting to watch Republicans talk about Democrats buying the election, but it's also very interesting to watch Democrats say that there should be no controls over spending, which is the opposite of what we've heard from the parties in the past.
Since we last spoke, by the way, in some of these competitive states, the difference in the ad rates is like 7-1 for Obama.
It is unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. Since we last talked, Sarah Palin has been in the news a lot. Yes, for her wardrobe, but lately also because of her, maverick independence.
Well, apparently independence from the McCain handlers or the people who are trying to handle her. There are a lot of people who are saying, let Sarah be Sarah. They want her, or que Sarah, Sarah, that song goes.
The Italian version.
Yeah, thank you very much. But it's very interesting to see how she has been. There are some buttons out there, campaign buttons, that say Palin McCain. There's a lot of infighting going on in the Republican Party, and if they are going to lose on Tuesday, which a lot of polls indicate that they very well could, you know there's going to be some kind of recriminations, and a lot of it has to do with Sarah Palin, whether she was the right choice, whether she should have been unleashed, whether her strategy was completely wrong.
And this has been grumblings over any number of issues. For one, Sarah Palin has tried to argue that the campaign ought to bring up the issue of Jeremiah Wright, the pastor for Barack Obama.
Yes, and there's a big dispute, a debate going on in the McCain camp. Of course, we only have 6 days to go, and the debate should be finalized by now. But whether to bring it up, whether to just focus on taxes or go the tougher route, the Reverend Wright, the Bill Ayers kind of controversies.
The Jeremiah Wright issue did come up not in a McCain ad, but in one of these independent so-called 527 groups. So this is a campaign ad produced by one of these outside groups.
Prisons. For 20 years, Barack Obama followed a preacher of hate and said nothing as Wright raged against our country.
Not God bless America, God damn America!
U.S. of KKKA!
He built his power base in Wright's church. Wright was his mentor, advisor, and close friend. For 20 years, Obama never complained until he ran for president. Barack Obama, too radical, too risky. The National Republican Trust PAC is responsible for the content of this advertisement.
And that's important to note, that tagline at the end there, Ken. This is not from the McCain campaign. It's not from the Republican National Committee.
People won't notice the difference. I mean, in 1988, when you saw the pictures of Willie Horton in many of those ads, they were not paid for by the Bush Quail ticket in 1988. It was paid for by an independent group. But nonetheless, the point is trying to make, the point they're trying to make, of course, is that Barack Obama is not a known quantity, despite this campaign. Only in the Senate for 3 years, there's a lot we don't know about him, a lot of associations we don't know about him, and the idea is to remind folks about people he's entertained in the past.
And, of course, the 527 groups are not all on one side. This is an ad produced by an outside group of so-called 527 attacking John McCain.
Some celebrities love to gamble. Paris, Brittany, John McCain.
John McCain loves the risk, betting at casinos, gambling with their lobbyists.
And the gambling interests love McCain. More casinos, more gambling.
McCain is gambling's go-to guy.
Those gambling interests have bet on McCain, too, with $1 million in campaign cash.
Jackpot.
Call McCain. Tell him to walk away from special interest money and support fair elections now.
Public Campaign Action Fund's Campaign Money Watch is responsible for the content of this advertising.
And that group, in turn, financed by the liberal group MoveOn.org. So it's a bit of an issue. Anyway, we got some people up with one thing about those. We haven't seen a lot of them. They haven't played the role that they played the Swift Boat commercials, for example, produced by an outside group 4 years ago. They just haven't played the same role this time around.
Well, part of it is the fact that everybody is obsessed, and rightly so, with the economy, the future of their earnings, and their children's future and their grandchildren's future. And I think had there not been this overwhelming fear, uncertainty about what their financial future is going to be like, I think perhaps they would have been able to play a larger role. But the economy has taken over the whole dialogue here.
We have some callers who think they know the answer to today's trivia question, our first trivia question, and that is, of course, if you know the identities of the first two women from major parties to face off against each other in a U.S. Senate contest. Let's go to George, and George with us from Tallahassee.
Oh, good afternoon, Mr. Ken and Mr. Neil.
Hi.
My guess is in 1986, Senator Barbara Mikulski ran against Linda Chavez in the state of Maryland.
That is correct. They ran against each other, but that was not the first time two women ran. That was an interesting race, and I think that may have been the first time since the time we're thinking of, but it was not the first one.
Okay.
Thanks, George.
Thanks.
Let's see if we can go next to, this is Mark, and Mark's calling us from Baltimore.
Yeah, but now I know I'm wrong because I was guessing 2002, Collins and Pingree in Maine.
Collins and Pingree, again, correct, but not the first.
Right, two women. Shelley Pingree, as a matter of fact, is probably going to win a House seat in Maine this year, and if Susan Collins is probably going to get reelected in Maine. The two of them ran against each other in 2002, but it was before 2002.
Thanks for the call, Mark.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And let's see if we can go now to Andrew. Andrew with us from Winston-Salem in North Carolina.
Yes, I'm going to say Margaret Chase Smith and Lucia Cormier.
That is correct. Maine, 1960.
Hey, the right answer. Thank you very much.
First time two women ran against each other in the Senate.
We also have, should note, we got the right answer by email from Brian, writing to us from South Africa.
Yeah, so he says.
Congratulations, Andrew. You win this week's no prize.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the answer. By the way, obviously a lot of important Senate races, the Democrats trying to get to the filibuster-proof majority of 60, and, the voters of Washington, D.C. may have decided one of those races.
Exactly. That's the unanimous jury that convicted Ted Stevens of Alaska on all seven felony counts. Ted Stevens insists he will run for re-election. John McCain, Sarah Palin, and others in the Republican Party have demanded almost that Ted Stevens resign immediately. He refuses to do that, and I suspect that what's going on here is that there's still a possibility. It sounds amazing because he's a convicted felon, and there's even some question whether he can vote for himself on Tuesday, but that if he runs and wins in Alaska, then he could resign, and then they'll have a special election. The governor cannot appoint a successor, but it would give Republicans an opportunity to hold the seat. Right now, if he runs, it looks like Mark Begich, the Democratic challenger, will win that seat. If he runs, though, and wins, and then then resigns, then Ted Stevens will be gone and the Republicans can start fresh.
Which raises a question. We have three United States senators running for national offices, for president or vice president this year. What happens if their seat should become available? First of all, Barack Obama in Illinois.
Well, Barack Obama, if he wins, Governor Rod Blagojevich, say that one time fast, the Democratic governor of Illinois will make a successor appointment. He can name whoever he wants. He can even appoint himself. It's obviously he'll appoint a Democrat, and considering that Barack Obama is the Senate's only African-American, Blagojevich will probably pick a black candidate. The question is whether he picks Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr., who clearly wants the seat, but is not...
And could be around for a long time.
Exactly, but there are other people there who's been around a long, long time. Emil Jones is the president of the state Senate. He's African-American. He's 73 years old. He's actually an Obama mentor. He could be a caretaker picker to pick until the next election.
And what about the state of Delaware, where Joe Biden is also running for re-election?
Same situation. You have a Democratic governor. She will make the appointment. It was always thought to be Beau Biden, the Attorney General of Delaware, who's going to be the pick, but he's now going to Iraq. He'll be in Iraq until October. So now they're talking about another caretaker pick until Beau Biden returns in 2010. The question is whether, if the Democrat is named this time, whether he or she would want to give up the post in 2010.
And then you have the Senate seat in Arizona held by John McCain, if he should win.
If John McCain, and here's what's different. You have a Democratic governor in Arizona, Janet Napolitano, but state law says that any successor to the Senate has to be appointed of the same party of the previous senator. So she has to name a Republican. What's interesting about that is that she also wants to run for the Senate in 2010. She could very well be picking the Republican whom she runs against.
Joe the Plumber, maybe.
That's right.
And finally, what if we need a new governor in Alaska?
Well, if Sarah Palin's elected vice president, then there's a simple situation there. The lieutenant governor, Sean Parnell, becomes governor.
Ken, stay with us. It's our Wednesday visit with the Political Junkie. And when we return, senior news analyst Daniel Schorr will join us to talk about the long view on this historic election. If you'd like to talk with Dan Schorr about this historic moment in American politics, give us a call, 800-989-8255. You can send us email, talk@npr.org. And if you'd like, you can join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, broadcasting from the Knight Studio inside the Newseum in Washington, D.C. Daniel Schorr needs no introduction to the millions who hear him on All Things Considered and Weekend Edition, both Saturday and Sunday. Of course, Dan came to NPR after a distinguished career at CBS News. He's also graced the studios at CNN, and his most recent book, Come to Think of It, is just out in paperback. It's a collection of commentaries by NPR senior news analyst, updated to include thoughts on the 2008 election. So if you'd like to talk with Dan about this moment in our political life, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org, and you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Of course, political junkie Ken Rudin will stay with us, and now Dan Schorr joins us here at the Newseum. And it's Dan, nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
My pleasure, Neil.
And Dan, so many have said this is the most important election of their lives. Your lifetime is longer than most. You've covered every administration going back to Dwight Eisenhower.
Going back to Franklin Roosevelt.
Okay, Franklin Roosevelt. What do you think? Is this the most important election of your lifetime?
There is a tendency to say whatever election is upon us now is the most important in my lifetime because we've already forgotten the rest. But it is a very, very important election, it seems to me, because I think what is at stake here is whether there is a realignment of the American population taking place. There was a period back in the 90s when this country moved towards the right, moved towards Republicans. The question now is, have they moved very far back now, and we're going to get a Democratic government on both branches, and that to see a realignment of America because of current conditions makes this very important.
It wasn't all that long ago that White House senior advisor Karl Rove was talking about a permanent Republican majority.
Yes, and Newt Gingrich came in, and he has contract with America, and he said we're going to run this country from now and forever. Newt Gingrich was wrong, too.
Yeah, and it does suggest that if those predicting another era of Democratic dominance of national politics could be wrong 2 or 4 years from now.
Of course. There is a volatility, I think, in the American public. And the idea that this happens now, but it may be very different 2 years and 4 years from now, is quite likely.
I wanted to ask you, the other thing you hear every 4 years is this has got to be the dirtiest presidential campaign ever.
It is dirty. It's dirty in a strange way, in that it deals in kind of unrealities. I mean, you know, if you get Joe Biden saying this new president will be tested when he comes into office, oh, tested. Oh, you think he's going to give us a crisis or whatever. And there is this way of picking up single words and weaving fantasy around them that didn't used to happen. But apparently it's not working, judging from the polls at least. The Democrats are not moved anymore by that. I don't know whether Willie Horton would move them now. I don't know whether Riverboats would move them now. But now they seem to be more than anything else influenced by the economic situation.
And that appears to be something that may not be being overblown. It's pretty dramatic.
That is very dramatic, and Americans are responding to it. I think you notice that even the Republican campaign now is beginning to think there's no use talking about some of these little things and so on and so forth, because all the public wants to hear about is what are you going to do about this big depression, as they call it.
Hmm. Let's see if we get some callers in on the conversation. Of course, our guest, Dan Shore, political junkie Ken Rudin, still with us, too. 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Let's begin with Rochelle. Rochelle with us from Charlottesville in Virginia.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My question for Mr. Shore is if he could comment on his perspective on how each generation may perceive differently how far we've come or not in racial relationships and how they affect national politics.
Well, that's a good question, a very important question, and one of the underlying questions which will be answered next Tuesday, because there is what is called the Bradley effect. When Bradley ran for governor in California, it turned out that the polls were wrong in predicting he would win. He lost, and the reason the polls were wrong was that a great number of people who would not vote for a black would not say that to the pollsters. Something that, well, we don't know how much of it may be happening now. And I think one of the things to wait for when you have now the first time a black running for president of the United States is whether America has or has not yet quite fully overcome its race consciousness.
Let me put that another way, Dan, and that is that some, when this race camp began, thought that there would be a very useful public dialogue on the issue of race. Other people were afraid that the campaign would descend into race baiting. I think what we've seen is somewhere in the middle, but how has the issue of race played out in this campaign?
Well, the way it's played out is that both sides have said, I'm not going to talk about race because I don't want to be accused of race baiting. So they made all these efforts to keep it as a submerged subject, but it sort of keeps popping up a little bit here and there. And you don't know for sure whether anybody's listening or anybody cares or whether there are people who care more than we know.
Rochelle, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And I wanted to ask, here's a question on email from Jason in Oakland, California. Why don't you ever talk about what all that money being spent on campaigns could do for people if it was not being shoved into the pockets of TV station owners? $1 billion, that could give health insurance to 1 million people.
The reason we don't do it is I count on you to do that. But I don't think that the function of people in journalism is to tell you this is what you should use your money for or this is how you should conduct yourself. But the fact that you feel strongly about it, all I can say to you is right on.
Let's get a question from here in the audience in the museum.
Hi, I'm Dale Johnson, and I'm here with the Wilson class. My question to Daniel Shore is why have we not heard or seen more of Hillary Clinton in the campaign for Barack Obama?
We've seen some of Hillary Clinton in the campaign, perhaps not as much as she could have done. She did make it very clear from the start that she was altogether going to work for him and be behind him. And I guess it was a decision of Obama and his advisors as to how much to use her. Tonight we're going to get Bill Clinton on the air with the president. And I think there are things which, if unless you are in politics deep into it, you kind of hope to understand the considerations, whether they base on how many Hillarys you want, one, two, three, four, and when. I frankly don't understand that process.
Ken, I wanted to, if you wanted to weigh in on that question.
Well, I mean, Dan's exactly right. I mean, she said she's going to do everything she can. She has done many rallies, and perhaps if the race were perceived to be closer and in some states where she could make a difference, she would. But right now, it's all Republican states where the battle seemed to be being fought in, you know, states like Ohio and Indiana and Florida, Missouri. And you wonder, you know, if there were Democratic states that were at stake and in play, perhaps she'd be used more.
Let's see if we get another caller on the line, and let's go to Randy. Randy with us from Fairfield in Iowa.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mike, I'm probably going to support John McCain, but I am dismayed by the Republican Party's need to turn to its conservative religious base. My question for Dan is there a centrist majority somewhere left in the U.S., whether identifying themselves as Republicans or Democrats, but people who are relatively non-ideological, relatively practical, like to see things get done and go well?
I'd like to see a lot of those, but when it comes down to an election campaign, you don't see very much of it. Americans are very wrought up about this election on both sides. And whether it be a vote for McCain or a vote for Obama, that is politics in America. And I'm afraid, however messy it is and how much money gets wasted that could be used for better purposes, that's democracy.
Ken?
When Barry Goldwater was defeated, he ran as a very strong conservative in 1964. When he was defeated, the party moved towards a centrist kind of a thing, and they nominated and elected Richard Nixon in 1966, but they ran as moderates. Here, if John McCain does lose, it looks like the party may be even tugged further to the right. If you look at what's going on in the Congress, the possible 2012, we're talking about 2012 already, 2012 Republican candidates. So it's interesting that they don't feel that a lot of the reasons the Republicans, if they're going to lose this year, a lot of them are saying that they just did not adhere to their conservative principles.
And Dan, he's looking ahead to what's been described as the battle for the soul of the Republican Party, and you talked about that a little bit too. But nevertheless, so did General Powell when he made his endorsement of Barack Obama.
I have a question, Dad. Am I allowed to ask a question, Ken?
Well, okay.
Governor Palin, let's suppose they lose this time, but this woman is a big force from now on in the Republican Party, isn't she?
It looks like that. I mean, she is. The crowds are coming to see her. They're talking about Palin in big letters and McCain in small letters in a lot of these rallies.
Here's an interesting email from Anne on this point. I've noticed the last couple of weeks Palin has been left off of the McCain ads. I've also noticed some lawn signs do not have Palin listed either. I've not heard this commented on in the media. Is that a trend?
No, I don't think so, actually, although, of course, as you get closer to the election, there are more and more states that need to be covered, and by having McCain and Palin travel together all the time, you lose the opportunity, whereas Obama and Biden have been traveling separately. But again, this week, you know...
May I ask a follow-up question?
Go ahead, Randy.
Because we saw many Democrats turning, or nominal Democrats, turning to the Republican Party since the time of Ronald Reagan. And I think we're seeing some nominal Republicans this time around turning perhaps more to Barack Obama.
Yes. Yeah.
Is there not room to move? My feeling is Bill Clinton turned very fast to the center after the failure of his initial health care proposal. Whether there's a third party that claims the center or not, is it not? Is there not significant migration towards the center among the American population to whichever party appears to hold the center?
Dan?
Yeah, well, it is true that in campaigns you tend to go to the extreme, and then after the campaign is over and if you have to govern, you begin to move towards the center. That is a historic trend, that in order to make speeches that Americans will listen to, you have to say extreme things. And then if you are elected, you then have to start doing unextreme things.
That was the old Richard Nixon slogan, right? He would appeal to the base when he was running for the nomination, but governing, he would move to the center.
Exactly right.
But you may have the phenomenon this time if Democrats, as again the polls suggest, have solid majorities in both houses of Congress, and if they win the White House too. Well, we heard an argument on this program the other day that you would have somebody governing from the center of their party, not necessarily the center of the country.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think I'm trying to recall the last time that you had the entire government except for the court in the hands
well,
of one
Well, we may just have the right person to answer that question well, sitting here on this panel.
I remember one quite vividly, of course, was Roosevelt and the New Deal with the Democratic Congress and did astonishing things. But when was the most recent time?
You had Bill Clinton's first 2 years when he was elected in 92. He had both House and Senate.
Right, right.
So it's very, you know, we were talking about trends and about things that could last for a long time, whether this would be a long-time Democratic realignment. You know, in 1972, when Richard Nixon won 49 states, 2 years later was Watergate. When Bill Clinton won in 1992, 2 years later was the Gingrich Revolution. So for all these times we think these are going to last forever, they could change on the next election. And for all we know, with Obama and Democratic control in the Congress in 2008, it's very possible that the Republicans could theoretically come back in 2010.
Randy, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you, although I now feel hopeless.
that's Ken's job on the panel. Ken Rudin, our political junkie, with us. We also have the great good fortune to have Daniel Shore with us today, his most recent book out in paperback, Come to Think of It. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And let's go now to Corona. Corona with us from Santa Rosa in California.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I'm actually very honored to be speaking with Mr. Shore. I've listened to you for a long, long time. I have a question with regard to the similarities that you see in the various campaigns that you have witnessed. And that is the rhetoric around Obama being too scary. He's, you know, obviously the first black man to run at this level for president, mm-hmm. and other times in history there were other people who were the first of their kind, let's say, to run for president. How has the rhetoric been the same? What kind of similarities have you seen?
Well, the similarities are, in every campaign that I can remember, if you ask what is the key word which gets used time and time and time again, it is change. Change is the big mantra. On both sides, they're arguing for change.
But Karun is right. The Republicans are increasingly using the word risky.
But then you have to say, you know, you're safe with me or you're not safe with my opponent. These are the typical campaign. I don't know whether Americans take them seriously anymore. It is my impression, subject to what you and Ken may say to correct me, is my impression that in the end, the one factor which is more likely to tell you who's going to win, who's going to lose, is the state of the economy at the time.
Ken?
But, Dan, I think part of the question was also that in 1960, John Kennedy, of course, was not black, but he was Catholic, and I guess perhaps being Catholic in 1960 was just as alien-sounding as African-American. I wondered, did you see something in 1960 with the attacks on Kennedy, his youth, inexperience, and religion comparable to 2008?
Well, with the Catholics, there was Al Smith, who was a great governor of New York, and was not elected because he was a Catholic. And so when Kennedy in 1960 was elected, they were breaking new ground. On the racial front, I think this country had been constantly breaking new ground. New ground is a question how far they'll go within any four-year cycle. As I suggested earlier, I am personally fascinated to know on Wednesday whether there was a sizable, whether the exit polls would indicate a sizable number of people who voted against Obama because he's black.
Karuna, thanks very much for the question.
Thank you very much.
And might want to recall that Al Smith might have been glad in retrospect he did not get elected. That was the campaign of 1928, followed shortly thereafter by the Great Depression.
Right.
As we look ahead to these economic times, Dan, though, I think a lot of people go back to their parents or their grandparents in some respects and say, remind us, what was this like? How bad was it? How long did it last? And the answers are pretty discouraging.
Yes, I understand what you're doing. You're taking advantage of the fact that the one contribution I can constantly make is my age. And so you can ask me, and I have clear memories.
I thought I was asking in a very nice way.
And you did very well. And this is an anniversary. October 29th is the anniversary of the stock market crash that then propelled us into this vast depression. And President Roosevelt came in, closed the banks. I can remember people on street corners selling apples. I mean, it really was very grim, outwardly more grim than it yet is to be in the United States. But this is getting to be fairly close to the Great Depression of the 29 and the 1930s.
We'll talk more with Daniel Schorr in a moment. Ken Rudin, our political junkie, is also with us. And, Ken, I understand you have a surprise for us to mark our last visit before the presidential election, an extra trivia question.
I think I do. Do we have time before that? Because I hear this terrible music in my ear.
But if you'll announce the trivia question.
I'll do that very fast. One of the hottest races this year is a Senate race in New Hampshire. Senator John Sununu and former Governor Gene Shaheen, they ran against each other 6 years ago. When was the last time a Senate rematch resulted in a different result from the first contest?
The answer when we come back. This is NPR News. Before the break, political junkie Ken Rudin gave us a second bonus trivia question. Ken, remind us, what's the question again?
I can't remember. Oh, yes, it's the one that one of the hottest Senate races, John Sununu, Gene Shaheen in New Hampshire. It's a rematch of what they had in 2002. When was the last time a Senate rematch resulted in a different result?
In the meantime, while people call in about that, 800-989-8255, or email us, talk@npr.org. Here's an email question from Kerry in Scotland, who identifies him or herself as an expat American who's lived abroad for 2 decades. Taking the longer view, how do you see a win by either Obama or McCain influencing the perception of the USA by the international community? Dan?
Well, it must be said that President Bush has been very unpopular almost everywhere outside the United States. And that you can simply assume that almost any change would result in an improvement in America's relations with the outside world. But especially, I think, in the case of Senator Obama, who talks more like a European, let me say, than McCain does. He talks in moderate terms. We will deal with this problem. None of this business of unconditional this or that. I think that everywhere from London to Tehran, that America's relations will begin to improve if and when Obama is elected.
And there was that extraordinary turnout of people in Berlin when Senator Obama...
200,000 people in Berlin. That was more than President Kennedy had in Berlin.
Well, he only had half a country then.
That's true. and a quarter of a city.
Let's see if we can get Larry on the line. And Larry's with us from Sheridan in Oregon.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, and I hope I'm not too far off topic here. Mr. Schorr, with all due respect, given your title as NPR Senior News Analyst, do you feel that your own personal opinions or biases show through in your commentary, and is there a certain responsibility on your part to portray neutrality?
Well, I have a certain amount of latitude because I'm called News Analyst rather than News Reporter. And during most of my life as a reporter, I really tried very hard to stand aside and look very, very disinterested. I do that mostly, I think, but not entirely, as a news analyst. I am given a certain latitude to give an impression of how not only how things are, but how they may be and how they got that way. And there may creep into that, I am willing to admit, at times, a sense of what I would like to be that way. I'm introduced that way. You can take it or leave it. I have an impression that you would leave it, and life goes on.
No, I appreciate your candidness on that, and there's no doubt there's a lot of fodder for you to comment on, and I do respect your opinion there. So,
And let me also add, as somebody who watched Dan Schorr for many years when he was a reporter, there are a few who could look disinterested in a more interesting way than Daniel Schorr. Larry, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate
it. Thank you. Good day.
And let's see, we have some people who think they know the answer to the trivia question. And let's begin with Bob. Bob's with us from Cedar Rapids in Iowa.
Hi there.
Hi there. Who do you think was the last time two people ran against each other and the result was reversed?
Well, I was just guessing that it was Lincoln and Douglas.
Ken?
Well, actually, they only ran each other. Well, they did run against each other twice.
But not for the same office.
Only once for the Senate, 1858 for the Senate, where Douglas won, and, of course, 1860 for the presidency, which Dan Shore covered. And I think that's a wonderful thing.
And he had Lincoln up by 3 points.
I know. Yes. Robocalls.
Thanks very much for the call, Kevin.
You bet.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go now to here's another answer. This is Phil. Phil's with us from Chapel Hill in North Carolina.
Hi there.
Hi.
I seem to remember something biblical like Mark and John Warner in Virginia.
Well, that's funny. They only ran against each other once in 1996. As a matter of fact, when Mark Warner ran against John Warner, his button said, vote for Mark, not John, with no last name. But they only ran against each other once for the Senate.
Oh, well.
Okay, so we'll leave the lines open, 800-989-8255, or send us an email, talk@npr.org. Here's an email question from Tom, and Tom. Benita, it says, hi, Tom. All right. My question is, do you believe that without the economic crisis, the Democrats would have had a chance to change the electoral map?
We'll never know. I mean, I did see the polls begin steadily to climb once we had this breakdown of our financial institutions, and what would have been if the situation had been different, I really don't know.
Ken, before the economic crisis erupted, the Republican John McCain seemed to have a lead in the polls. But again, that was right after the Republican convention, and that's the kind of bounce you would expect from the polls. Before that, Senator Obama had a lead pretty much all summer.
That's true, but there was a bigger bump coming out of the Republican convention than the Democrats had. Sarah Palin was thought to turn a lot of blue states into potential red states, but as Dan said, once the economic news got bad, so did the fortunes of the Republican Party.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Jay. Jay with us from Sedgwick, Maine.
Hello. Before I get to my question, I've got a New Hampshire palindrome for you. Wonder if Sununu's fired now. How do you like that?
Wonder if Sununu's fired now. Okay.
There you go. Okay, that's not my question.
Jay, you've got too much time on your hands.
yeah, I do. Mr. Shore, you're probably one of the only working journalists around right now that remembers the third-party candidacies of two men named Wallace. And I'm just wondering if you can speak to the effect that the candidacy of Henry Wallace had lo those many years ago on the whole phenomenon of the third party, and also what his candidacy projected for the, let's call it, the left wing of American politics. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well, that's right.
Thanks for the call, Jim.
Yeah, Wallace indeed was trying to take the Democratic Party on a turn further to the left than most people in the party wanted. And I think Wallace cost the Democratic Party a great deal. Now, George Wallace was an entirely different thing. George Wallace was simply going to fight the last fight in this country for outright segregation. And as you know, he was assassinated.
He was shot. He was
excuse me. That's right. He was shot and wounded.
And what's so fascinating about that 1948 election is that Harry Truman had people from the left, Henry Wallace, and from the right on the Democratic Party, Strom Thurmond, who was then a Democrat, pulling away from the extremes, and yet somehow Truman managed to win that election in 48.
Let's see if we can get Jose on the line. Now, Jose thinks he has an answer to the trivia question. Go ahead, Jose.
Yes, hi. In New Hampshire, 1975, Durkin versus Wyman.
Wow, I didn't even think of that one. Now, this is a great story, but but anyway, Louis Wyman was elected, was thought to have won the 1974 race by 4 votes, but the Senate never seated him. So,
That's a technicality.
Well, no, it isn't, because there's something more recent. I said the last time. There's something more recent. And then in the special election, John Durkin won the race, as you all remember, when Norris Cotton retired, huh? You don't hear Norris Cotton's name on the show that often.
Cotton Mather, but not Norris Cotton. Anyway, Jose, thanks very much for the call.
I like that.
We really like people who make Ken think. Yeah.
Thank you.
Let's see if we can get another answer. This is from Ed, and Ed's with us from Norwich in Connecticut.
Hello. I'm guessing Chafee Reed in Rhode Island.
Chafee and Reed actually never ran against each other. There's two senators, but John Chafee and Jack Reed never ran against each other. So, and his son, of course, Lincoln Chafee, was defeated by Jack Reed, but they never ran against. Oh no, Sheldon Whitehouse beat Jack Reed.
Right.
Sheldon Whitehouse beat Lincoln Chafee, but and then Douglas beat Lincoln in 1858.
No, okay, yes,
they didn't run against each other.
Okay, thanks, Ed. Why don't we put people out of their misery?
I will. Yes, I now announce my resignation from this show. Howard Metzenbaum and Robert Taft in Ohio in 1976. Taft beat Metzenbaum in 1970. 6 years later, Metzenbaum returned the favor.
And who was Howard Metzenbaum's favorite tennis partner?
Was it Dan Shore?
I could have been Daniel Shore. Yes, indeed.
We praised him.
Here's an email question from Greg in Augusta, Georgia. Why would a candidate believe that preempting a World Series baseball game to show us how presidential an American he is would make him appear more presidential or American? So are to believe he not only wants change in the operations of government, wants to change our traditions as well. I'm an independent who usually leans Democratic, probably not this time. That, of course, referring to Barack Obama, who's buying time on Fox and a number of other TV networks this evening to make a half-hour infomercial, Perot-like.
Well, actually, this is the first I've ever heard. I didn't even realize there was a World Series this year. Apparently, there are two teams playing.
Yeah.
Nobody's watching.
Evidently,
it.
Yeah.
No, but most likely, I think the last game and on the game before that, the game didn't start until 8:37 p.m. Eastern time. So if Barack Obama buys the half hour from 8 to 8:30, the Phillies and the Rays could still start at 8:37.
They're going to start 15 minutes later than scheduled previously, but they're, of course, resuming the suspended game five in the bottom half of the sixth inning with the pitcher due up for the Philadelphia Phillies, and the score tied 2-2.
And so, you know this, every time the Phillies have won the World Series, Republicans have won the White House.
The other one that Ken mentions this all the time, the other one of his statements, we've got down to a Gregorian chant, which is, no president has ever won the White House without Ohio. So,
and look at the polls in Ohio right now. The last I've seen is Obama with anywhere between a 5 and 8 point lead. And again, that's crucial for if John McCain's going to have a shot on Tuesday.
We're talking with political junkie Ken Rudin, as we do every Wednesday. Our special guest this week, Daniel Shore, NPR senior news analyst. His new book, Come to Think of It, his collection of commentaries from National Public Radio's senior news analyst, is out in paperback, updated to include his thoughts about the 2008 presidential election. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let me ask both of you, as veteran political observers, what are you going to look for on election night? Ken, what's the early indicators for you next Tuesday night?
Well, I think, and everybody who's listening to this, dozens of people listen to the show around
Absolutely,
the country.
Yeah.
I think it's very important to look at the things that the states that close early. For example, at 7 p.m. Eastern time, Georgia closes early. If there's a big African-American turnout, Senator Saxby Chambliss could be in big trouble. Indiana closes at 7 p.m. Eastern time. If Barack Obama is going to pick up a state, a red state, Indiana is a possibility, a state that hasn't gone Democratic since 64. So that's something to watch for. 7:30, North Carolina. If Elizabeth Dole goes down, it could be a big African-American turnout. Obama has a shot at North Carolina. Ohio is also 7:30. If John McCain fails to win Ohio, of course, this may be hours and hours of counting, but it'll be very interesting to see the numbers, early numbers in those key states.
He's made a big investment of time and money in the state of Pennsylvania, which a lot of people find puzzling because all the polls there have the Democrat Barack Obama with a double-digit lead.
Yeah, I don't see. It's a very puzzling thing. A lot of Republicans saying, look, let's take all the money and just focus it on Senate races. But it is interesting that McCain is spending time in that blue state of Pennsylvania when there are so many red states at risk for him.
Dan Shore, what are you going to be looking for election night?
Well, about the same thing. It's all a function of the time zone and the time of polls close, and all those that Ken listed as the ones that we'll have to look at first. But they give you a good enough sampling so that those first three or four that are close, if you can see the result there, you'll be pretty well know the result for the whole thing.
And we're going to be watching this at Dan's house, and everybody's invited to come watch it.
Watch it, Dan. The other interesting results that you get on Election Day, of course, are the exit polls. These are the questions asked by pollsters of voters as they come out of the polls on Election Day. Some of those become available during the day. Some of them only become available that night or even the next day. But, Dan, what are some of the interesting questions you're going to be looking at from those exit polls about why people voted the way they did?
Well, first of all, I want to know demographically, did older people on the average vote differently than younger people on the average? There's been a lot of talk of there being a big surge of new registrations of young people, and it is said that most of them tend to vote for Obama. I don't know that. But the thing is, break it down demographically, then break it down on the issue of the economy. It appears that in all the polls recently, if you ask who's better able to deal with the present meltdown in the economy, most people tend to say Obama. I'd like to see whether that's carried out in the election.
And as you said earlier on the question of race, if people are going to vote against Senator Obama because of his
race. And the question of race. Since we have North Carolina, a place with large black contingents, it'll be interesting to know very soon whether there was a Bradley effect, whether there were people who didn't want to tell pollsters that they would not vote for a black, but then voted for a black.
Ken, what are you going to be looking
for? I'd like to know that of people who are deciding late whether the McCain arguments work, because there's a lot of speculation that the people who are undecided now may ultimately vote for McCain. I'd like to know if the late deciding voters went for McCain or not.
And Dan, finally, we've had elections the last 8 years in particular that were almost 50 plus one elections, very,
yes,
very close,
right.
And president elected with bare majorities and highly contestable results. There is a possibility, again, we don't want to go out on a limb and say who's going to win, but there is a possibility that you could have a very different result this time. Barack Obama appears to be running a campaign that is intended. A lot of Democrats are wondering, why are you spending so much time in North Carolina? You don't have to win North Carolina. He seems to be interested in winning a result that would give him a transformative result, over 300 electoral votes, the ability to say, I am America's president.
I think that's right. It was Colin Powell who used the phrase when endorsing Obama that he's transformative, if you like that. And that's the big question there. Are we really, is the country which says in polls that they think they're on the wrong track now, have they decided what the right track is? Do they believe that Obama is going to take them on the right track? I think is the underlying question.
And Ken Rudin, there are still pathways for John McCain to win this election, but if so, he's going to win by a nose.
Absolutely. And again, as we said earlier, that every state that seems to be in play right now are red states. For John McCain to win, he's going to probably have to give up on Pennsylvania and focus on the Floridas, the Indianas, the Missouris, the Ohios, the states that George W. Bush won in 2000 and 2004. He's going to have to hold them if the Republicans are going to keep the White House.
And finally, we're going to end with two emails. From Sean Mitchell in Kansas. Mr. Shore, I want to thank you for your dedication and commitment to truthful, insightful reporting. We are all better off for your educated, insightful, and thoughtful reporting.
Thank you, Kirsten.
And then this from Catherine from Phoenixville, Pennsylvania. Where will dear Ken Rudin be on election evening, and where will he be after the election concludes? He's been a great asset to Wednesdays on Talk of the Nation.
That was very nice. We'll be, of course, we have an NPR special from 7 p.m. to 3 a.m. Eastern Time, and there will be in NPR studios in Washington covering the election. And, Neil, I think we have an announcement about this venue.
Well, next Wednesday afternoon, Ken will be back with us with an election special from Studio 3A, and we'll be doing another special the next day from here in the museum, Talk of the World, we're calling it. So thanks very much for being with us, Ken Rudin.
Thanks, Neil.
And, of course, NPR senior news analyst Daniel Shore. Dan, as always, thank you.
Great pleasure.
I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.